You are listening to the cycling podcast, A de Tour de France in association with RAFA, the fastest closing in a world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with RAFA in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam. Stage 10, today we're in Albi.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are in a lovely little square in Gaillac. Do you know the Tour de France's history with Gaillac?
You're about to tell us.
It's only hosted one start or finish of a Tour de France stage, and that was in 2003, the very memorable time trial from Gaillac to Cap Découverte. Is that the correct pronunciation, Francois?
Cap Découverte, yeah.
Thank you. Where Jan Ulrich beat Lance Armstrong by 1 minute 36 seconds, which at the time was a real seismic result in the Tour. It didn't derail Armstrong from winning the Tour, though. And we're what? Half an hour away from Albi, where the stage finished this afternoon and where the race will have its rest day tomorrow.
The wind is blowing, a light breeze now really, but the wind has been the story of the day, hasn't it? It was windy this morning at the start as we drove down from our beautiful hotel. What was the village called again, Francois, will you remind me?
It was La Voûte-Chillac.
Lovely place, yeah. Very remote in the mountains. And we drove down to the start in Saint-Flour, and it was noticeable that as we drove in, not that we were late, but we were certainly getting there at the towards the later end of the available time slots to arrive, shall we say. But there were
fashionably late.
There were teams that were behind us. Well, Astana arrived at the same time as us, and Groupama FDJ behind them. And they were both quite late. They were both cutting it quite fine. And there was a lot of stress around the Astana bus this morning. Omar Fraile rode right into me, went over my foot. He almost came off himself. And I was told that it was a lot of stress because they were staying 2 kilometres away. And they were told they would get a police escort to the start. That didn't materialise. And they had to go the long way around. And the riders weren't very happy about it. Now, is it a coincidence that those two teams were the big losers today? Who knows? But a lot happened today, so let's have the tale of the attack, please, Lionel.
Okay, Richard. Yes, well, stage 10 from Saint-Flour to Albi, 217.5 kilometres, and it was a stage win for Wout van Aert, the Belgian sensation riding his first Tour de France for Jumbo-Visma. That was his team's fourth stage win of the race after Mike Tournison on the opening day, and then the team time trial, and then Dylan Groenewegen on Friday. But that doesn't tell even a fraction of the story. There was a five-man break of Tony Galopin of AG2R, Nathaniel Berhane of Cofidis, Anthony Turgis of Total Direct Energy, Mads Voorts of Katusha, and Odd Christian Eiking of Wanty Gobert. They were joined by Michael Schaar of CCC to make it six, and so far, so predictable on what could and perhaps should have been just a sort of transitional stage taking us gently into the rest day. But the final 75 kilometres were all action, with the wind causing first concern and then chaos, and the tension really ramped up through the late afternoon as the wind got stronger and less predictable, or perhaps more predictable for those who were in the know. And in the final 30 kilometres, really all hell broke loose. The first casualty was George Bennett, the Kiwi with Jumbo Visma, lying fourth overall this morning, perhaps still reeling from New Zealand's defeat to England in the Cricket World Cup final yesterday. He didn't take that too well, did he? But with 33 kilometres to go, he found himself trapped in a third group on the road after reportedly going back for bottles at his own insistence. We'll maybe dig into that a little bit more in the episode. And then a few kilometres after that, when the six leaders were caught, Team Ineos had come to the front to really pile on the pressure, and they forced the decisive splits. Caught out were Thibaut Pinot, Jakob Fuglsang, Rigoberto Urán, Richie Porte and Giulio Ciccone. That group did get to within around 11 or 12 or 13 seconds, depending on reports, with around 15 kilometres to go. But then the bungee rope snapped and the time losses were hugely damaging. Up at the front, Van Aert won the uphill sprint ahead of Viviani, Ewan and Matthews. Also in that group, the significant names were Julian Alaphilippe, the yellow jersey, Geraint Thomas, Egan Bernal, Kruijswijk, Bardet, Quintana, Adam Yates and Dan Martin. And then it was all eyes on the clock. At 1 minute 40 came the group containing Mollema, Pinot, Uran, Port and Fuglsang. Landa and Ciccone came in at 2:09. Nibali was at 5:04, so game definitively over for him. And George Bennett in at 9:41. So Alaphilippe now leads Thomas by 1:12. Bernalis 4 seconds back. And you would have to say Team Ineos have played an absolute blinder today. 10 days into the race, the rest day tomorrow will count the damage and the consequences of the wind blowing. But first, let's hear from a man who had, well, arguably the best seat in the house, Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, who is in the director's car just behind, well, all the action that was taking place. Richard spoke to him earlier on this evening.
I mean, well, you had a great view of what happened today. Was it? You know, were there signs that there were that this was going to happen, or did it really come out of nowhere?
No, you had signs. You had signs for about 30 kilometers before it really happened, because you could feel the teams were moving to the front. You could feel that some of the riders were really struggling at the back, and you could feel that the DSs were telling their riders, go to the front, there's a side wind, and there's a possibility for Echelon. So you could really feel it, I mean, at least for 30 kilometers before, and then it really happens. And that was, it was amazing, yeah.
I mean, was it a case of, was it the strength of the wind that dictated just the carnage, or was it the identity of the teams that went to the front and really drilled it?
It's a bit of everything. I mean, you don't need to have that much wind. It was windy enough, and the wind was coming from the right side. It was obviously a side wind, so that was perfect. And then obviously, when you have teams like Ineos and De Koenig moving to the front and putting the pressure on, well, then everything explodes. And also, this is the 10th stage of the Tour de France, so some guys are really struggling and are getting more and more tired. So we hoped it would happen, and it did, which is great for the show.
I mean, you've sat behind the bunch on many stages, Seb. Was that as thrilling a stage as you've witnessed from that vantage point?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's always thrilling. I mean, the first memory I have of an Echelon stage was Saint-Amand-Montrond, a stage won by Mark Cavendish quite a few years ago. And yeah, it's super exciting because, from my perspective, being in the director's car number two, I can't really see what's exactly going on. So I try to look at the riders in the third group, the riders in the second group, and it's always exciting to find out that suddenly, oh, there's Pinot in that group, oh, there's Fuglsang in that group, oh, at the front you have Dan Martin, and you have all the De Koenigs, and you have Bernal. So it's always exciting to see who are in the different groups. Yeah, and I was really impressed by one man who was maybe born in Ghent or in Anvers, and his name is Nairo Quintana. He impressed me on Paris-Nice, and he showed he was a real Flandrian once again.
I mean, you've got the best view of the race at the back, because the action is really at the back on a crosswind stage like today, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great being at the back. It's also great because once the gaps are more or less established, we move up. So we were behind the third group, and we moved to the second group, and then we moved to the yellow jersey group. As I said, you get to see who's in the third group, then you get to see who's in the second group. You start to understand the tactics of the different teams and why some of the teams are riding in the front. It's always a fantastic show, the Echelons.
If only Thibaut Pinot had your ability to jump from Echelon to Echelon.
Oh, indeed. I find it pretty interesting because Thibaut Pinot was interviewed at the start, at the finish, by a colleague from France Television, and the question was absolutely brilliant. The question was, so you had a bad day, and Thibaut went, and he turned around and went.
The fastest closing in a World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our headline sponsor. Look out for the EF Gone Racing films from the Tour de France, behind the scenes with EF Education First. And if you want to be a Pedaleur de Charme, then you can become one by buying a Rafa Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt or cycling jersey or casquette. And I think at this tour I've been more aware of people sending us pictures or posting them on social media of them wearing their Pedaleur de Charme cycling podcast gear. So by purchasing that range of clothing, you are helping to support the podcast. So thank you very much in, you know, psychologically boosting our morale, but also financially as well. So thank you very much. And thanks to Rafa. So we heard from Seb Piquet just before the break there. Some fascinating thoughts from him. You know, there was no surprise about what happened in the sense that the wind was blowing pretty strong. And in conditions like that, you know, you're going to get teams like, in particular, De Koenig, Quickstep, Bora Hansgrohe I would put in that category now as well, and Team Ineos, who obviously have the goal of protecting their two leaders, who were both up there. And there were losers as well. The big losers were Jakob Fuglsang and Thibaut Pinot. And I mentioned the fact that both teams were quite late to the start. Who knows whether that was significant, but Francois, you spoke, I think, to Yvon Madiot, one of the sports directors at FDJ.
Yeah, exactly. We were making quite of a, you know, a summary of the first week of the tour. He said, well, he was saying, so far, so good, we didn't make any mistake. And I told, and before I left him, I said, and oh, what about today? What's the wind like? And he said, oh, the wind is, you know, backwind for two-thirds of the race and then crosswind in the last third, so we must be cautious. So they knew what was going to happen. And the funny thing is, Julien Alaphilippe, at the finish, he said exactly the same. He said, everybody knew there would be crosswind. Exactly where the question would take place, we knew it would happen 35 km from the finish. So everybody was warned. So what happened was, and that's what he said. He said Deceuninck Quickstep didn't try to create an echelon, and I don't think Team Ineos either tried to create an echelon. It was only a matter of a positioning, and because of the strength of the teams, if you apart from Jumbo Visma, apart from George Bennett, who in my opinion, really lost it today, because actually, I mean, Jumbo Visma played it well, they won the stage, but apart from that little hiccup in the Jumbo Visma team, I mean, all the strongest teams in terms of cohesion that were there at the front, and I'm thinking the current Quickstep will launch the move, Bora Hansgrohe, we know how tight a team they are, even Team Sunweb was there with Matthews, and of course Team Ineos, because cohesion is one of their strengths. Lack of cohesion, probably lack of good positioning from Groupama FDJ meant they, knowing what was going to happen, they couldn't do anything about it. Pinot was not so badly placed when the split took place, but with only William Bonnet and Stefan Kung, you could say these guys are great riders and should be enough, but it wasn't enough to avoid the split, and as we're going to see and discuss, it was not enough either to chase when the split took place, because I mean, we discussed it with Lionel in the car. The way they handled the chase was probably not adequate either.
Yeah, I mean, my contention is that they sort of panicked a bit. I mean, they did have another 15 kilometers to bring that in. They got very close. The job was to get back on before the finish. I mean, that was the job, and they failed to execute that. I know we can, it's easy for me to say, sitting here, armchair sports director or armchair cyclist, well, they should have just maybe kept cool a little bit. Richard, you made the point, and it's a completely valid point, that when you're behind, you want to get back on terms as quickly as possible, because then once you're in the wheels, Ineos then would go, well, they're all back on, so there's no point absolutely drilling it now, or they, you know, it might ease the pace at the front a little bit. I completely get that, but they did have a bit more time to get back on. I mean, they didn't judge the effort over the distance that was available, and that was the only job they had to do.
Yeah, but I disagree with you there completely. I think you have to, in that situation, you have to close it as quickly as you can, because as long as there's a gap, and it closed today to 11 seconds, you know, they could almost reach out and touch them. But as long as there's a gap, the front group has this momentum and this huge psychological advantage. They're throwing coal on the fire. They're gaining by working, whereas the psychology of chasing is very, very different. And for as long as that's the case, I think there's this momentum that builds in the front group. and it becomes harder and harder for the group behind to close the gap. And I think that in any echelon racing, you have to close the gap as quickly as you possibly can. It's why you sometimes see guys trying to jump across.
Yeah, but one thing supporting Lionel as opinion on this on the matter is that it was like the fireworks last night for Bastille Day in a way, when you got all these things popping up all over the place. And the most important moment in that echelon was when actually the second group, the Pinot group, came back within 11 seconds of the main peloton. And all of a sudden, it all cracks. William Bonnet, who was with Pinot, it totally cracked at that very moment. There were, I think, two Astana riders with Jakob Fuglsang. They also they just couldn't do anything anymore. And we saw Pinot and Fuglsang chasing themselves, and that's when it was dead. You know, that's the very moment when the 11 seconds quickly, in a matter of a 1K, became 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 40 seconds, and that's finished. So
then,
maybe at the pace, their effort just a little bit differently, they might have done it.
Well, they went too hard on the hill. They killed everyone on the hill. And had they got over that hill, and again, easy for me to say, sitting looking at the printed profile, but even watching the run-in and the roads to the finish, they really needed to just hold it together and buy in a bit of cooperation and say, you know, let's try and, you know, they were so close. And I think with a slightly more cool-blooded approach, they possibly could have got back on terms. But I completely accept what you're saying, Rich. They didn't want to be that with the gap between them and the front group. And of course, while the gap is open, the momentum and the incentive is totally with the front group. Very, very easy for the chasers. Once it's down to like Pinot and Fuglsang chasing themselves, the game really was up by that point. But perhaps they should have just... somebody should have just said, well, hang on a minute, if we can just get over this hill and then treat the last 15, 16 kilometres as a separate job, roping a bit of help,
I think,
get back on terms.
In the end, yes, that would have been a better strategy, but I think it would have still been damage limitation. I think what they did was they tried to close the gap. They tried to get back on terms, and in trying to do so, blew up completely.
Yeah.
So in hindsight, they'd have been better off, you know, managing the resources better and accepting that they were going to lose a bit of time. But I think in those situations, you do panic. Anybody panics, and it's what makes, you know, bike racing so interesting. This may have cost Fuglsang and Pinot the Tour today. They may be stronger in the high mountains, but they've lost the Tour today, perhaps, on a day where it's all about positioning and team, as you mentioned, team cohesion. Francois
made the point at La Planche des Belles Filles about how hard won those seconds were on a climb like that. In the big mountains, it's even harder to crack people, isn't it? I mean, they either crack spectacularly and are out of the picture completely, or it's like teasing out a few seconds.
We don't expect the margins to be that big. Yeah.
So to throw away a minute and 40 like that is, so, I mean, they would, had they just had that moment of clarity, okay, 30 seconds, not ideal, but let's just get in as quickly as we can. They rush of blood, the insistence on closing the gap rather than limiting losses, really. And you know, that really has been very costly for them.
Losing the Tour today, in my opinion, is probably a little bit exaggerated, because if you take Pinot, he took 30 seconds of the other favourite the other day, lost 140 this day, today, so that's 110. It might look a lot, but he lost 110 on who? You know, he lost 110 mainly on Bernal and Geraint Thomas, which it's funny the way we discuss the positions, and the way the positions were discussed during the echelon implied that already we had made our own hierarchy of the Tour and what the GC was meant to look at the finish, because for us, obviously, when we mention these guys, even though we seem to believe that the first week didn't, you know, it was not really that important, everything will happen in the third week. In this case, we're discussing Bernal, Thomas, Pinot, Fuglsang, and maybe Uran, and a little bit Quintana. We've already decided that these six guys would win. One of these six guys would win the Tour. And these little things, team time trial, La Planche des Belles Filles, the Pinot Alaphilippe raid, and today's Echelon, they might not look like very important. We'll see in the end what importance they have. But they already managed to kind of sort out the men from the boys, and there's only like five or six guys left in contention.
Yeah, but you're talking about the defending champion and Egan Bernal, who we all kind of agreed was sure. on paper the potential, sure. and it's 1:40. I mean, how hard do you have to work to make 1:40 on a mountaintop finish? I mean, and just to see that time go away on a day like today.
Sure. The funny thing is, once again, we knew and we said, and maybe we didn't say it as bluntly as we should because we're cautious and it was the beginning of the Tour, but in at the back of our mind, every one of us, every single journalist in the press room, had a number one favorite Bernal, number two favorite Geraint Thomas, and then who else on the podium? Probably Fuglsang. During the first week of the Tour, Pinot had replaced Fuglsang because Fuglsang crashed, but these today, you know, just before the first rest day, I mean, this idea, this, you know, preconception we had at the start got confirmed. We have two guys who didn't make any mistake, because even Quintana lost a little bit of time in the team time trial and in other instances, but these are the two favorites for the Tour more than ever. And behind the real interesting fight, again, almost as usual, is who will be third.
Well, we always focus on the losses, don't we, in these situations. But let's give credit to Team Ineos for the way they rode. I mean, you know, the bucking bronco of riding in the crosswinds like that. They really they got aboard and they held on tight and they made it happen, didn't they? And they for Thomas and Bernal to have Luke Rowe and Gianni Moscon in their corner. I mean, they didn't put a foot wrong, and Dylan Van Baarle as well.
Michel Kwiatkowski. I mean, look at the team.
I mean, but they were was a real supreme.
Seb Piquet mentioned Paris-Nice. You know, Quintana, rode very well. Bernal as well. Two guys you maybe don't expect to be up there in that front echelon. But Luke Rowe again, the sort of orchestra conductor, wasn't it? He was instrumental. Marcus Burghardt was very strong for Bora Hansgrohe, Daniel Oss, you know, and then Kasper Asgreen, Yves Lampaert, and all these guys for the Koenig Quickstep as well. There were some real big engines up there. Let's hear a bit from Geraint Thomas, though, who also, you know, came through. We saw Geraint Thomas and Julian Alaphilippe both driving it too on the front. Here's what Geraint Thomas, one of the day's big winners, had to say at the finish.
Geraint, is the word for that exhilarating?
I think... yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I couldn't think of anything better. But a really good day, I guess, in the end. You know, we had a little go a bit earlier, but it wasn't really the right conditions. And then, you know, EF had a little go and then Quickstep, and we were just always attentive and ready for anything. And really good day in the end, yeah.
And I guess the key was that everyone in that front group was very committed, weren't they? There were a lot of guys there working pretty hard.
Yeah, obviously, from our point of view, we had everyone bar two guys. So we all just committed, and then I can't even remember, like Bora were there, and there was plenty of guys anyway turning, and you know, behind, you could tell they went full, especially on the climb to try and close it, and then because they didn't then, I think they just like ran out of gas, and then that's when the elastic snapped then, and we got such a big gap.
Pino's lost over a minute, Fuglsang has as well. It's a huge blow you've landed today, isn't it?
Yeah, especially on a day like today where you'd never expect it, really. You know, I think it's just a positioning error from them, and they lose over a minute and a half. So great from our point of view. Surprised so many missed out, I guess. And like I said, I think they committed full to try and close it as quickly as possible. And then when they didn't manage that by the top of the climb, then we just had, you know, numbers and kept turning, and that's when the elastic snapped and we really gained a bit of time.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, you'll be familiar with the voice of Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, literally in the driving seat of the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by our friends at beer52.com. You can try a case of Beer 52's beers by paying just the £4.95 delivery charge. You get 8 incredible craft beers, a copy of Ferment magazine, and a snack delivered to your door. And this month's beers are coming all the way from the USA, from Boston in particular. Some of the greatest breweries in America come from Boston in the Northeast. Included in the collection are Harpoon's Take 5 Session IPA. That sounds like the one for me. Clown Shoes. No, that sounds like the one for me. Galactica Double IPA and UFO. That sounds like the one for you, Richard. Extraterrestrial.
Not sure how to take that.
You can mix and match. If you don't like darker beers, you could choose just the lighter ones. And if you don't like lighter ones, choose the darker ones. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take your free case and cancel at any time you want. Go to beer52.com/cycling. That's beer52.com/cycling.
We mentioned that in Nairo Quintana, a good day for Quintana, a very bad day for his teammate Mika Landa, who had a pretty nasty crash when he was well positioned. There was it seemed to be that Warren Barguil maybe just touched Julian Alaphilippe's wheel, lost control himself, did very well not to fall off, but in doing so took out Mika Landa, who crashed at the side. I didn't see him at the finish, but it looked nasty from the footage.
He didn't come out of the bus. I spent, you know, most of my after the finish, I spent like 20 minutes at the Movistar bus waiting for Landa. He never came out and said he would only talk tomorrow at the press conference on rest day. So obviously a little bit of damage there, and it's a shame for Movistar. They rode like one of the big teams, and they really learned to. I mean, remember the day when we were in. In Holland, in his on those boulders at the start of the tour a couple of years back, when Quintana lost, well, I think exactly 140 or 150 in an echelon. They've learned that how to ride in echelons. And unfortunately for Landa, you know, it crashed at the worst possible time.
Quintana is looking good, but you know, one of the pre-race favourites, Jakob Fuglsang. A bad day for him, and I was surprised at that. We were talking this morning or last night, I think, about how quiet Astana have been. You know, one of the teams we've not seen going in any breakaways, despite having riders like Omar Frehley, Magnus Cort, who could win stages. And my suspicion was they were, you know, really keeping their powder dry for the high mountains. But I would have expected, and Luis Leon Sanchez, riders like that, I would have expected them to have coped a lot better today with the conditions and with what happened when Fuglsang was distanced. I spoke to their sports director, Lars Michelsen, at the finish. Here's what he had to say.
Well, you know, I know the teammates did what they could, and but it's racing, and I think they brought it back to like 10 seconds or even less, but then they exploded. Well, he was not the only one losing time, was he, from the GC? So let's see. Let's take it easy and see what happens. There's a few stages left to try to make it up. If he had been up in the right position, he would have been in the first group, of course. So I think he's unhappy himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're up there, you don't lose time. Now he was not up there. Now he's losing time. So, yeah.
As I said before, we focus on the people who've lost time, but really the story is the people who didn't lose time. I mean, Steven Kruiswijk was in that front group, a very good ride by him. Emmanuel Buchmann was in there for Bora Hansgrohe. Enric Mas was in there for De Koenig Quickstep. Obviously had the benefit of, you know, following his teammates Alaphilippe and Viviani, who were clearly going to be in that front split. But the two names that kind of not surprised me, but riders that you would think might be slightly vulnerable in terrain like this, Adam Yates and Dan Martin. And we've seen Dan Martin caught out in similar situations in the Tour before, but I wonder how significant it is that Adam Yates had Matteo Trentin up there trying to, you know, get into the split in order to contest for the stage. I mean, he was eighth in the end, and Dan Martin had Jasper Philipsen, who was sixth in the end. You know, really handy teammates and wheels to follow when the split started to happen, and they were on the right side of them. Where,
yeah, as, but where were they? Where were they at La Planche de Bellefille? You know, Kruiswijk and Dan Martin. So, you know, it's really in a first week like this, you know, it's so unpredictable. It's really down to really adapt at the you know, at the end moment to the situation. This day, as well, they were on the right side of the situation. Kreuzweig, we're not surprised. I mean, he knows how to ride in echelons. Dan Martin, I agree. And Adam Yates, I think the Mitchelton Scott in the last couple of years have also, you know, stage echelons themselves. But yeah, you're right. Dan Martin might be the surprising one there. A quick mention of Enric Mas, because when you know, he's someone that's not fancied, but every day since Julian Alaphilippe was in a yellow jersey, the last man with Julian Alaphilippe on all terrains for the past 6 days was Enric Mas. He's always been riding on the front. We know what he did in Vuelta last year. He's a young rider with lots of potential. He's actually, even if the Koenig Quickstep are not saying it, he's their real GC leader. So, a little penny on not an underdog, a guy who could, you know, finish in the top 15 or even better.
Well, second in the Vuelta last year and won a stage, of course. He was going like a bag of washing in the Tour de Suisse just before the Tour de France. Certainly looked to me, I mean, he got up the road one day but didn't look convincing at all. Has been completely overshadowed by teammates this week, but now six overall before we've really climbed anything more significant than La Planche des Belles Filles. So, as we go into that first rest day, De Koenig Quickstep have got the yellow jersey, but they've also got their better GC hope extremely well placed.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2019 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. SISCP25. Little shout out for our show that we're doing in Harrogate at the World Championships on the Friday evening. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com, live events, the tab down the side, live events, and you can get tickets there for that show where Francois will join us. It'll be myself, Lionel, Daniel Freeb, and perhaps a special guest too. Talks are ongoing. Any other business from today's dramatic stage? I know we're close to rest day, Lionel, when you start talking about bags of washing.
Well, I already did my washing a few days ago. And there's a washing machine in our Airbnb this evening, which Francois was delighted to discover. Just need to get some washing powder.
That's the problem. I mean, you know, in case of emergency, we've all done it, washing our laundry without any washing powder, which is better than nothing.
You say we've all done it.
I've never done that. No,
you've never eaten cold spaghetti either. You know, when you didn't have any. You know, when the gas and power was cut off. I mean, you never were a student. Oh well.
No, definitely use washing powder. But we'll go on the hunt for that. Tomorrow is a rest day, and it's funny, isn't it? Because the complexion of the race seems different after today. We were heading into the rest day serenely, sort of mouths watering at the prospect of how the race might unfold over the next week or so, because it seems so open, so finely balanced, so well poised, really. And now, I mean, maybe as Francois in his you know, typically blunt way says that all we've got is confirmation of what we expect at the start. But you always hope, don't you? And you always certainly course, hope for a race with lots of contenders.
One thing that we haven't seen, and I was talking this morning to a couple of team directors, you know, like the chit-chat outside of the bus, chit-chat, nothing worth recording, or the things that they wouldn't tell you if you had a microphone. And they were all saying, you know, like I told them, yeah, well, I heard that, you know, it's the most relaxed first week of the tour for the last decade or something. That's what some riders said, and they say, oh, beware, it's not the case at all. They all said that the way the course was designed was actually to wear out the riders in very different kind of exercise. You have the team time trial, which is hard on cardio and you know, intense. Then you've got La Planche, but if even if it's not, you know, the high mountain stage. It's you know, they had to change gear, to change bikes, to change type of efforts almost every day. Today in the wind, the day before, I mean, the stage with Saint-Etienne, with, you know, always up and down. And really, I can tell you, well, that's what all of the guys were saying, especially with the rest, they've been pushed, you know, back one day. They're all getting to the rest day with a lot of relief, because it might not seem obvious, but they're already tired, very
well,
tired.
Well, I mean, Seb made that point as well, which, again, you know, he's got the best view. Well, he's looking at the back of the bunch, and that's in many ways the best vantage point. He can see, certainly on a day like today, how the splits happen. It's when just somebody loses a wheel because they're tired, they're fatigued, and with an extra day of racing before the rest day, you know, that might have been just a little factor today.
Yeah, and although we are kind of looking at the result now thinking, well, Thomas and Bernal are second and third overall already, having at least Pinot ahead of them, gave that little bit of doubt, but it still might be unpredictable from here on in.
Hopefully.
But the thing we learned today is that no matter what, you know, Ineos riders, they can fall in a pile of dung and still come out eating strawberries. I don't know quite how they do it, but they it's all, you know, everyone else has lost something somewhere today, apart from Ineos and arguably, yeah,
don't forget, you know, the Giro when Geraint Thomas was their leader a couple of years back. It can I don't wish for that, but from time to time it can go wrong. You can crash. Confirmation, of course, but we all hope not that Ineos, you know, fade out for the wrong reasons, but we hope for a little bit more competition. And I think that Pinot losing time today, and the way he did lose time, was probably a sound warning from him. In a bizarre way, it's better for him to lose time now than crash completely in the mountains later on. I guess maybe the great first week he had so far, the kind of lost a little bit of their attention and probably there was a kind of overconfidence, you know. They thought, oh well, you know, we've been doing everything right the first time in many years, and so yeah, you know, off guard. You should never. I mean, that's probably the mistake Team Ineos or Team Sky in the past never did. Never ever lose your concentration for 1 second.
And we saw the other day, you know, even when Geraint Thomas crashed, the damage was minimal because of the way they were organized and were able to support him to get back up to the group, not getting back on his bike in the first place. And then it was well drilled, and you know, for what might have been a catastrophic incident, nothing was really lost in the grand scheme of things. And you know, today it wasn't Pinot that lost the wheel. You know, Pinot's form is obviously amazing. Mm-hmm. He's going really well. He didn't have a bad day physically. Somebody up ahead of him lost the wheel, and it's somebody else's fault.
Of course.
So he's paying a very heavy price for something that, you know, physically he's the same rider that he was yesterday.
But wow, positioning, isn't it? I mean, that's the harsh thing.
Be,
I mean,
but the split might be the 30th rider or the 35th rider. You can still be in the top 50 and be caught in that situation.
Yeah.
Now, okay, you can argue, well, he should be in the top 30, but...
Well, especially when you know that it's going to happen, especially when you know that it's going to be crosswinds, 35Ks, which raises the question we have to talk about even quickly. I was about to say swear, but what the heck happened to George Bennett? What did he do? I mean...
Well, the story we heard was that he had insisted on going back for bottles himself. I mean, if that's the case, well, I mean, surprising.
Yeah, we were all fancying, you know, even if it was, you know, looking far ahead and there would have been lots of conditions, but to have, you know, the first New Zealander in the yellow jersey.
Well, he was close, wasn't he? And once, you know, if Alaphilippe fell away on one of these big climbs, then Bennett was in pole position really to take the yellow jersey. So yeah, huge missed opportunity, and he'll be kicking himself tonight, because it sounds in his case like there was an error there, a clear error. But anyway, we'll maybe catch up with him and find out exactly what went on. You know, he came into this tour to support Stephen Kruijswijk first and foremost, mm-hmm. I guess. So
for Jumbo Visma, I don't think it was a bad day.
No,
you hardly mentioned Wout van Aert. I mean, he's been promising this, hasn't he? And he beat some. The look on Viviani's face as he crossed the line was just, you know, one of surprise. But Jumbo Visma have won three sprint stages with three different
riders,
sprinters,
yeah,
which is incredible.
I've got a stat here.
Has that been done before?
Yeah, what's been done before is actually a Dutch team won five stages with four different riders.
Super Convex?
In the only once did it happen recently, or the last time it happened actually, in the first 10 stages of the tour was in 1982.
TI Rally.
They won the team time trial and they won four stages with four different riders. So it's happened.
But I mean, the teams had 10 riders each, and there's only about 10 teams in the race in those days. So
yeah,
I mean,
TI Rally were kind of dominating the field, especially in the early stages of the tour.
Yeah.
Still, you know, it's been done before.
Not bad. Mm. Any other business from tonight? Oh, how could I forget?
Well, we nearly did forget. We nearly, having got almost through to the first rest day outside the team bus, almost didn't happen today. a couple of days ago in our hotel, the Cofidis press officer,
Antoine,
was in our hotel, and he approached us and said, are you recording a podcast? And we explained who we were, and he said, we'd love to do more with you. We're going to be a world tour next year, Cofidis. So they were offering the moon on a stick. And so I said, I'd like to talk to Nathaniel Berhane, the Eritrean champion. Sure, come to the bus. Okay, what about in a couple of days' time? No problem. So I went to the bus this morning, and first of all, I was told that Berhane, who had a crash a couple of days ago and has got a bandage on his right knee, I think, was having a little bit of extra physio just to make sure he was ready for the stage. No problem. Then it was, he'll talk to you after he's come back from sign-on. No problem. Then when he came back from sign-on, he darted very quickly into the bus, and I thought, I'm not going to push it here. Then when we got in the car, Richard, you said...
It was very coffer disappointing, wasn't it?
It was coffer disappointing. But when we got in the car, you said... Berhane is in the early break and he was out in front for three quarters of the day. I wanted to speak to him at the finish, but because Cofidis are staying in Albi,
you fell into a pile of dung and came up eating strawberries, didn't you, Lionel, today?
I came up with a mouthful of dung and straw. So Cofidis were staying in Albi, so although their bus was at the finish, their riders had just gone straight to the hotel. No luck there. So fortunately, I did manage to speak to somebody else outside their team bus.
Outside the team bus, with
Oliver Naarsen, AG2R La Mondiale.
I think everybody was anticipating problems with the wind. Opportunities, let's call them opportunities. Because we had a tailwind for, I think, 150k and then 70k side winds. So then everybody knows you have to be in the front, and there's no place in the front for everybody. You spin out, you're riding 70, 80 k's an hour, and splits happen.
So where were you when it was all starting to split up? And more crucially, where was Romain Bardet?
He was on my wheel with Cheryl. The three of us were like in 15th, 20th position where we were actually since that point where the side wind started, because we knew where we had to be. And it's we have a lot of confidence in those situations. It's something I love doing very much. And I don't think I've ever missed an echelon, and I wasn't planning on doing that today.
Is a crosswind the same wherever you are? Is the crosswinds here the same as in Flanders?
Oh, no. There's plenty of crosswinds. There are rules for that. In Flanders and in France, Tour de France, you need like 25, 30 k's an hour winds. In Qatar, you need 15 k's an hour. In Belgium, you need 20 k's an hour. You need long straights, open fields, and then magic can happen.
And in terms of Romain Bardet, he was very harsh on himself after La Planche de Belfi, the comments he made. To gain some time, not on everybody, but on some people, must be a boost to morale, not just for him, but for the team.
I think especially for his morale and his mental state, it's important.
I mean, what's he like in the team this year? Does he have the same kind of confidence as in previous years?
Before the start, I'd say yes. After Planche de Belfi, that cracked him a bit, I think, but now it's coming back. I feel like now there's a good ambience in the bus the last days, and I hope it keeps getting better.
And lastly, you were in the break the other day and you were trying to go across to that move. Just describe how hard that was and how close to making it did you get?
I think we were, the closest was like 5 seconds, I think. That's an all-outer. You give what you have, and if you make it, you can win. If you don't, you don't. And unfortunately, it was the latter for me.
Is it a bit like having the door closed slowly in your face?
Yeah, but really slowly, yeah, because I believed in it until 1K to go, and unfortunately, I had to stop believing then.
Oh, well, Oliver Naasen, AG2R Le Mondial there. Now, teammate of Romain Bardet, a master of these crosswind stages, a very, very good, sort of, I think, still underrated rider.
Mm.
So, well, interesting to hear from him.
Interesting to hear his different take on how crosswinds are different in different countries, and also the fact that Bardet's confidence is returning. And although he didn't gain on everybody, he did gain on some people today, and looking upwards rather than downwards.
Just before we go, Kilometre Zero, sponsored by Hansgrohe. Episode 6 came out today. That was part 2 of Lionel's conversation with David Walsh about the 1999 Tour de France, the first of Lance Armstrong's wins. Fascinating, that was, too. Tomorrow's episode is about the press officers. Kind of new job in professional cycling. When I started 15 years ago or so, there may be one or two press officers. All the teams now have at least one press officer. So we've spoken to quite a few of them, and that episode will come out tomorrow. Thank you very much to Hansgrohe for enabling us to make the morning episodes of Kilometre Zero. Much more to come. And before we go, a reminder that you can stand a chance of winning the folding bike, the Austin Cycles Atto, which I've been darting around on this morning, exploring our lovely village. And you can win that if you enter our competition. Sign up to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com. In the newsletter, there's a link to click, and you can leave your name and the reason why you should win the bike. So go for it. So before we go, I must say thank you to some more friends of the podcast. Thank you very much for supporting us by signing up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thanks to Michael Hart, Laurent Audibert, Ralph Percival. Oh. You know Laurent?
No, I know Laurent. Laurent. Nice guy. Yeah. Hi, Laurent.
Yeah. Hello, Laurent.
And thanks again, Laurent. Danny Murphy, Alex Gidley, and Antonio Jose Mateo Cabrera.
And a big thank you to Lee Jackson, Jack Waters, Andrew Broadway, Jonathan Deering, Gareth Downs, and George Patelopoulos.
And thank you to Stephen Carr, Philip Lennon, Jake Hollins, and Phil Ransom. And also a big thank you to friend of the podcast Luke and his dad Chris Williams, who are both currently in hospital in Switzerland with broken femurs sustained in the same accident just 2 hours into their annual Alpine cycling holiday. That's real terrible luck, and I hope that you are both on the mend as quickly as possible. Darren and Luan say that the podcast is the only thing keeping them chipper at the moment, so get well soon, and thanks for listening.